This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the only investment research platform built for fundamental investors. Think about how hard you are working to get the insights you need to make a great investment decision, how many hours you spend digging through public records and expert transcripts, or manually updating those complex models. Investors should compete on their ability to analyze investments, not how well they aggregate data. That's why Tegas offers a unified end-to-end research platform that combines robust qualitative content sets, up-to-date financial data, management and culture checks, and more, all in one easy-to-use, streamlined user experience. 95% of the top 20 global private equity firms use Tegas. Learn more and get your free trial at tegas.com/Patrick. Today's episode is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn a 5.1% annual percentage yield with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say for certain that's the highest interest rate out there, we can say that at the time of this recording, that's higher than Robinhood, higher than SoFi, Marcus, Wealthfront, higher rate than Betterment, Capital One, Ally, Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo. I think you get the point here. If you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. Full disclosures and terms and conditions can be found in the podcast description, U.S. members only.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com.
All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Welcome back to Business Breakdowns. Today we're covering a behemoth in the research market, Gartner. Our guest is Alvise Pejion, portfolio manager at Fairlight Asset Management. Now, I don't know how many of our listeners make Breakdowns a family listening experience, but earmuffs for the kiddos for a moment. The way I would present Gartner is very much in the cover your ass economy. Executives are willing to pay $20,000 to $30,000 for reports or $50,000 plus for full subscriptions so they can access the insights and data collected by Gartner to help them make business decisions, purchasing decisions, and pivoting decisions. Alvise helps us cover how Gartner grew into this at-scale player, how the research and sales model has been fine-tuned over time, and particularly over the last 20 years, and where the opportunity for growth is in the future. It's a very interesting business with a lot of interesting dynamics that I think investors think about a lot. So please enjoy this breakdown of Gartner. All right, Alvise, I am very excited to break down Gartner. It is a name that I have a personal interest in. I came from a research background. I also revolve around the world of expert networks and consulting. So all of this hits very close to home. And I wanted to just start out with how you would define Gartner and the industry that they operate in, just to kick us off.
They provide research for the executive large corporations, but that might feel a bit abstract. So I think one of the best ways to really understand what Gartner do is to really put yourself in one of the customer's shoes. So let's imagine for a second that you are the chief technology officer of a Fortune 1000 company. And then the board asks you to provide them with a summary on some IT topic. For example, can you please provide us with a summary of how artificial intelligence would impact our business? What are the positive things that it can bring? What are the risks? And where is the industry going? And yes, you have a lot of experience, but you've only got 2 weeks to go and prepare for this. So despite you having an IT budget that is probably in the millions, by accessing Gartner, you can immediately have the ability to really read all the resources they have an online portal where you can find everything you need. The problem is a lot of information is not always good. If you don't have the time to read it all, it's not really much use. So what Gartner's offer you as well is the ability to talk to the people that have written those research. They are the experts. So you can even actually meet in person with them if you want. By doing this, you can really quickly have a feeling for what the industry is doing on a particular topic. You can understand what the vendors are offering in that particular aspect. You can also see, very importantly, what other companies that might be in a similar situation might be doing. So all this really cuts on time. And at the same time, it provides you with a very credible source for this information. And I think this is quite important. So when you get to present at the board meeting, you can really reference some brand name that has been in the market for a long time and is quite famous for their research.
And just thinking about you, you work in the investment field. You have investment banks that are producing research. You have analysts that you can speak to when they write that research. Is it fair to say this is that version, that model of sell-side research, but applying it more to the corporate world where instead of having hedge funds, mutual funds, investors as the clients, you have the corporations as the clients?
That's not a bad parallel, but I would make a key distinction here. So when Gartner writes something to you, they don't have ulterior motives. They really are providing you for something that you are paying very clearly for it. So the research tends to be maybe a bit academic to some extent, but then the ability of talking to somebody makes it quite easy. It's not like a broker report, a sell side report, where yes, might be very good, but there's always that feeling that there's a bit of fear of missing out. You got to act now, you got to trade. And that's one of the differences.
The sell-side research conspiracy theories. I've worked in the field. I wouldn't say that's always the case, but I certainly hear it. I certainly hear that there's maybe less conflicts of interest or less concern, certainly, from all of the publicity out there.
Especially also because with that research, it might be available now, but there's no certainty that it's going to be a follow-up piece. Sometimes there's not much grounding in the assumptions behind what you said. While with Gartner, you have decades of library content available there, and you can be mostly assured that there's going to be more development on the existing library.
And thinking about who they will compete against in this field, who are the competitors to Gartner? If you're not using Gartner, who would you use?
Well, that's a very good question. Gartner is the only global player that can provide research at scale at the moment. So there aren't really many alternatives if you really wanted to find somebody that provides you with that research. What you could do perhaps is you could piece together a number of research from a different set of providers, but obviously then you just have to hope that actually the answer is in there for what you're looking for. And definitely it's not a time effective way of going about it. Alternatively as well, you could call in management consultants, so companies like McKinsey or perhaps even Deloitte. The problem is at that point in time, your thoughts are going to be relatively general. You won't have specific questions to ask them. You just want to really understand first what's the environment like and then zoom in particular questions. Perhaps later on, when you really have a good feel for what the problem I mentioned before was artificial intelligence, how it could affect your business. Once you understand the general environment, then you can ask specific questions to McKinsey. I think that's how I think it in my head anyway. And then at the same time, they would be quite costly. So a Gartner seat access would cost you about $50,000. You could also probably ask your team to help you out. The reality though is most people are time constrained in those roles, and the outcome of the effort is likely to be quite below the quality of what Gartner can give you because they have 2,500 resources to do the reports, not 204. And at the same time, they give you that big brand name that you can reference during your board meetings. It's much more powerful to say, well, I think this is where the industry is going and I can back this by data that I sourced from Gartner, rather than saying, well, John from IT Googled this topic for 2 weeks and this is why I think I should be doing this.
And just putting Gartner at scale, just getting some sense of what they actually look like today from some type of metrics. You mentioned they're a global leader. They have a full offering of topics. What do you think the best metrics are just to bring that scale and size of the business to life?
Gartner at the moment has $5 billion in contract value. So that would be the metric management always refers to. And that's pretty much the goal of the business. contract value. Obviously, you got to grow that profitably, and that's what I've been doing for many decades. But if there is one metric to understand the business and put it into some context, is that contract value metric. And that 5 billion breaks down in, think that they have 18,000 clients, and on average, each of them has about 4 to 5 seats, and each of these seats costs around $50,000. So if you multiply these elements, you get roughly to where the contract value at the moment is. And if we want to frame the opportunity, where Ghana could it be in a few years, there are thousands and thousands of chief technology officers and people in IT that don't have the experience of actually sitting down with a Ghana representative and really understand how the service can really improve their workflow. So there's a big number of these executives that haven't been reached yet. So to do so, Ghana employs an army of salespeople. At the moment, I think they have about 4,500, if not even more. And the sole job of these people is to really nurture the existing customer base, but also to reach out to these executives that don't have much of an idea of how Ghana can help them and really over time convert them. And so if you want to put some numbers around these, Ghana itself suggests that there is about 140,000 enterprise leaders in the addressable market, but at the moment they only have 18,000 clients. So really they have penetrated less, well, about 10% of this opportunity. And then the other way that Ghana can really expand its market is really to sell more seats to the existing customer base. And that I think is quite plausible that it could happen, because not only IT is becoming more and more important, so there's more people working in IT, but also Ghana over the years, and specifically in the last 5 years, has really expanded a number of topics that it covers. So not only provides IT research, but at the moment also provides research about supply chain management, human resources, the legal function. So I don't think it's a stretch to think that just the number of customers could double, but also the number of seats sold per customer could double over time. And if you were to extrapolate their market share and sort of come up with a overall market, it's not too hard to get to a 50 billion potential market. And at the moment, given that they only have 5 and they are the leading player, we're not overly worried about the length of the growth runway. It feels just by doing simple math to feel quite long.
When you think about penetrating those additional customers that they don't have right now, are there certain types of logos that aren't included in the business? Are they overly tilted towards Fortune 100 companies or overly tilted towards IT heavy businesses or certain geographies?
They're definitely a service that is targeted to large corporations. So that's the first point. They could target as well medium-sized corporations. The problem is that at $50,000, I know that I made it sound like it's the best bargain ever, but it's still $50,000. So you can't go to any company and suggest that they should invest in that. But there are plenty that have that. So that would be the first thing to point out. Then in terms of geography, it's a global business, but given its origin, it's a center around the United States. And also because most of vendors in IT are American companies. But they also have very good presence in Europe and to an extent in developed Asia. So they are a global company. And I think their research will resonate very well with any of those markets around the world, which are English speaking, but also used to conduct business in English. The library is a very good asset, but it's very costly to translate in different languages. So you need the user to be well-versed in doing business in English. So all those developing markets at the moment either doesn't have the funding to buy the product or the language barrier is an issue.
And I know there's some element of being a customer, inclusion in some of the reports, a bit of a pay-to-play angle as well. How would you frame that as just part of the sales proposition for Gartner to clients, in addition to the research and expertise that they're getting?
So here we need to make, I think, a distinction between the type of clients, because most of the clients, the great majority, are actually corporations in search of insight that they can actually implement. Then a smaller part of the business has as customers the vendors. And so maybe that's where this conflict or maybe this perception has come about, where you feel that, okay, if I'm researching this vendor and I'm getting paid by them to do the research, there might be a bit of a conflict. is a smaller part of Gartner's business. And here it is where they compete with a company called IDC. But in the scale of things, because Gartner is such a big business, it's hard to really, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, but as a side, I'd say it's the smaller part of the opportunity for Gartner.
Yeah, just looking at my notes here, it looks like it represents about 25% of revenue today. So maybe a small part of the business, to your point, a smaller part of the opportunity for growth for Gartner. I wanted to transition a bit in terms of pricing. You talked a little bit about these licenses. Is it a single tier license? Are there various pricing points based on access to reports versus access to analysts? Just talk us through the complexity in terms of how they price the bundle that they offer.
The company itself doesn't really disclose too much about it, but my observations and my research suggest that it works a bit like that. There are different tiers, but they're not massively different between them. I think if you want to speak more with analysts, it costs a little bit more. Gartner not only provides research, but it also has two ancillary businesses, which account for about 20% of their sales, one being consulting and the other being conferences. So for consulting, you definitely pay aside and it's not part of it, but you have the option to include tickets to conference and bundle it in your Gartner seat. So I think that also can change the upfront cost. But I think in general, the average customer spends around $250,000 a year. Those five seats using a $50,000 average might be slightly different, but I wouldn't put too much stress about perhaps the company can grow a lot faster if they can move people from one tier to the next one or something similar. But in reality, I don't think it's yet one of the big drivers or the main drivers of Gartner's growth. I think it's more really just reaching all those executives that I haven't got in the network yet.
You alluded a bit to the ancillary businesses, consulting and events, 20%. It's interesting, you go back in time 15 years ago, those were closer to 40%. So maybe we could talk a bit about the history in general and that mix shift over time. Bring us back to maybe we start at the beginning of Gartner, how this business was created and turned into the behemoth. And then we can get into the business mix shift because I think that's an interesting dynamic as well.
Looking at the history of Gartner, I think we can segment it into four phases. So the first one is relating to the beginnings of the business. So it's a relatively young company. It was founded in the late 70s by Gideon Gartner, who was originally a consultant for IBM. So during the first years of Gartner, it made sense for the company to really specialize on advising customers on what IBM products they should be buying or what the features are. But then over time, as the company started growing, they really branched out into other parts of the vendor ecosystem. They also branched into marketing and supply chain research. So this is really the first phase of the company. Then moving to a second phase, I think we can trace this back to 2004, which was the year in which Eugene Ho became the CEO of Gartner. So Eugene came from ADP, Automatic Data Processing. And in that job, before joining Gartner, he was in charge of about $2 billion worth of payroll services. And these sales were made to big corporations. And at the same time, he was leading an army of 1,600 software developers. So you can see there are some similarities to Gartner in the sense that he was in a job where he was serving a service to large corporations, and he was in charge of a lot of people. So people had high expectations about the impact that he could make at Gartner, but it did deliver way ahead of expectation, I'd say, because once he joined Gartner, he started really to double down investment in the quality of the research, but also very specifically made the sales force a key focus for Gartner. As I alluded earlier, research is great, but it sort of needs to be sold. And so by doing this, it allowed Gartner to really start growing organically double digits. And they were able to do this for quite a number of years until they reached 2017. And a main event happened that year, which I think it's what can lead us to maybe a third phase of the company's history. So second phase, big organic growth. And then in 2017, they decided to acquire another business. So what they did, they acquired a company called Corporate Executive Board. And this was, again, another research provider, but it was not centered around IT. It was selling research, particularly on human resources, supply chain, legal, finance. So other parts of the research universe where Gartner wasn't as big. So it was quite a complementary deal, quite a strategic one. So the acquisition added about $600 million to sales, and the combined group by 2018 had about $3.4 billion in revenues. By then, Gartner was already a leading force in the industry, but by doing this deal, not only got bigger, but also expanded and made its addressable market a lot bigger. So that was a very important deal. And then the last phase of Gartner's history is really from that deal onwards today. And during this period, organic growth remained the main goal, and it resumed at 10% plus until today. What I think is important to also notice is that acquisitions are always risky. So Gartner had struggled for a few months to integrate the business, but the strategic fit, overall concept was so good that after a year of trying to tinker around and trying to really find the right formula, that business really started growing. And at the moment, it's outpacing the growth of the IT part of the business.
Very interesting. Going all the way back to the beginning, there was a time where you never got fired for buying IBM, and someone created a business around how you should buy IBM. And there's something absolutely brilliant about that and how that connects to that claim.
Yeah, it's a funny story as well that after a few years that Gideon Gartner started the business focusing on IBM, I think IBM actually sued them because they were worried that they were actually giving too much away to clients in terms of IP.
Wow. I wonder if that was a positive press outcome for him in terms of the potential marketing on the back of that.
I think the company never got convicted on anything, and it was just probably just something that happened there.
Clearly, it's worked out. I want to tap into the sales force and the sales function a little bit. I think you mentioned 18,000 customers against sales force of about 4,000. So you can do the math there just in terms of how many people they have working to manage those relationships, let's say 4-to-1 in terms of existing clients to salesperson ratio, plus trying to bring in new business. Is there anything that they're doing beyond just hitting the ground hard and trying to sell these contracts? Because as you mentioned, 50,000, when you're talking about several licenses potentially per firm, it's not small necessarily. So it requires a decision maker's approval. Is there anything in the sales function that you would point to as a key strategic difference maker for Gartner?
I think the main job of the salespeople is really to draw out why Gartner's product really adds value. And when they are able to do this, and usually takes months and a lot of engagement, but the moment this sinks in with the executive, price becomes a very secondary issue. Usually the budgets are quite big. For instance, in Australia, one of the big banks definitely are most likely a Gartner user, and the budget of the CTO is in the billion. So spending $100,000 to $500,000 on Gartner seats, it really pays itself extremely quickly. In my example before, the chief technology officer had that task to do. He had in 2 weeks to come up with an answer on artificial intelligence, but probably just even that paid off by itself. And then you got the remaining 11 months so that you can still use it and gain value out of it. So in terms of what other things salespeople do, I think they have one goal, and that is to drive contract value growth. They also help a lot to, I wouldn't say cross-sell, because I see the conference business as supporting the research business. The conference business is well and truly profitable on their own merits, but salespeople calling, inviting them to these conferences or make them attend, it all creates more point of contact where the customer can really have a feel for what Gartner is all about.
You alluded to the 12-month nature of the contract. Are all contracts structured as annual contracts? Are there any multi-year? And anything you could share on what churn looks like? Sounds like there's not much churn, but any type of data around that is useful as well.
I think it's great to talk about the financial model. We have four key elements. The first one being organic growth, then the margin, then the cash flow, and finally capital allocation. So we can discuss one by one these ones, and I flesh out where the nature of the contracts really help. So starting with organic growth, about 90% of Gartner's research business is based on subscription contracts. These are annual contracts. Half of these are multi-year contracts, but we're not talking about 5 years or anything like that. Usually, I think it's 2 to 3 years. So when we look at contract value, Gartner has been growing it at 10 to 12% per year. So how does this break down? So the current book of business tend to grow about 4% per annum. So net retention is quite high at about 100%. And then on top of that, Ghana is able to implement a 3 to 4% price increase per year. And then the remaining 6 to 7% to get to that 10% growth, it's coming from new customers. And then the other part, which I think is important in the financial model, is the understanding about the margin. The business has inherent operating leverage because content creation only needs to be done once. And so you get over time small incremental margin expansion as the number of customers grows. And at the same time, the research business is growing faster than the consulting one and the conferences one. So because the research business is a 70% plus gross profit margin business, so higher than the other ones as well, this also adds to the profitability, to the margin expansion that has been happening over time. But then if we really want to understand why the financial model is so good for Ghana and why it makes such a great business, it's really cash flow. So all the subscription contents that we talked about before, they all are paid upfront. So Ghana gets the money straight away, but then needs to pay for its employees, and they can do that over the remaining 12 months. So it has all this cash that piles in. And if you were to think, then the obvious question becomes, well, because for each dollar of profit, they generate $1.20 of free cash flow at least, what is the management going to do with all this cash? And this is where the fourth element of the financial model comes in, which is the capital allocation piece. So Ghana has been returning all this money back to shareholders, and the way they've done so has been through buybacks. And they have shown that they have a very good understanding of the value of their shares. So they're actually really being very good at speeding up the pace at which they've been buying back shares in relation to where the share price trades. And to give an example, in 2020, after the COVID-19 pandemic erupted and we had that big market collapse, they were able in the subsequent quarters to buy back 7% of the company shares on quite attractive valuations. So that really helped shareholders to really get a lot of value. And it has been one of the ways that management added value over time. So I guess this links well to shareholder returns. So you start with organic growth, top line growth at around 10%. And then as we mentioned, you get as well that margin expansion, which adds a little bit to your growth of earnings. And then on top of that, you got this constant reduction of the share count. So while Ghana has been growing top line, it's been able to compound EPS at 25% since 2004 when Eugene Hall joined the business and really refocused it around the research business.
Those are special businesses that can grow earnings faster than revenue and free cash flow faster than earnings. They're hard to find, but when you do, they're special. I want to tap into each of those categories a little bit. On the organic revenue growth, you mentioned they're 50% multi-year contracts, but each year they're getting 3 to 4% pricing growth, driving that 10%. So are they implementing that pricing on some of those multi-year contracts? Otherwise, it would imply that the pricing hikes on annual contracts would be much higher than 3 to 4%. And I'm just trying to gauge how much pricing power they actually have.
I'm not entirely sure how those contracts are structured because I think it goes case by case. But one thing I would say that has been apparent to me is that in order to get those multi-year contracts, Gartner doesn't discount. So the goal is not really to lock in customers for the long term through a contractual way. It's more, here's the research. Look how much money is saving you. I'm sure that once you understand that, you're going to subscribe every year. So there's never been that big focus on these longer term contracts.
And on the margin point, what you mentioned there about running that research business as if it's a software business, build once, sell infinite times. How much has that actually driven a margin change in the overall business? And maybe you can bring it down to EBITDA margin. Has that trended in a certain direction? What does it look like for the corporation?
That's a very interesting topic actually to unpack because you made the comparison with a software business, but in reality, Ghana never had the explosive margin expansion that you would expect with a software business in terms of they have from operating leverage. And the reason being is that at the core of Ghana service is that ability to call, to be able to pick up the phone at any point in time and being able to speak straight away with an expert. So while revenue has been growing on the back of new customers and while those researchers were doing the reports of all the customers, you have over time a bit of inflation in the number of experts you need. not only because IT is getting more complex, but also because you need to remain true to that promise that you can pick up the phone and talk to an expert at any point in time. So the margin hadn't been expanding a lot for a number of years, but once the pandemic hit, I think the business was able to really focus the cost base to an environment where people were actually more comfortable in speaking remotely to these advisors, with these researchers. And so once you cut the number of people that actually require an in-person meeting, you actually can get a lot more efficiency from your existing base of researchers. So that helped in the last few years to really improve the margin. And obviously, this wasn't the only reason why. Most businesses you probably noticed during the last few years have learned a lot from the pandemic and became more efficient. Gartner now at the moment is earning 300 to 400 basis points more in terms of the EBITDA margin than they were years ago. So there's a big debate on whether this is sustainable or not. But I think most have concluded by now that we've seen enough quarters post-pandemic to suggest that the new cost base is probably here to stay, and we could probably enjoy more operating leverage in the P&L that we have had before the pandemic.
And where has that EBITDA margin normalized at, that 300 basis points?
It's just above 20%.
Yeah, I think the software comparison was obviously not an apples to apples, as many companies would like to be software businesses and maybe stretch the definition of what a software business really is. But certainly a lot of operating leverage when you can sell that research, and not everyone is going to need the call. So that can stretch far.
Yeah, and I think long term, because we mentioned before, the big opportunity is to really go after these executives that don't know yet about Gartner's ability to help them. Once the customer base penetration increases, I think they can do a lot in terms of resizing the P&L, and I think we will have more expansion in the margin that we have had historically.
And in terms of cyclicality in the revenue base, when you go back in time and look at the financial crisis or even during COVID, how much volatility was there in revenue?
The IT industry tends to grow. So even during crisis, the number of people usually taking care of IT functions doesn't really shrink much. So they're quite resilient to that point of view, as many other IT firms are as well. And then what really helps them is the fact that they are providing a service that usually helps businesses to get more efficient. So during tough times, the value of a Gartner research seat actually increases. Having said that, though, it still costs $50,000. So the ability to attract new clients sort of decreases during tough times. But if we look at what happened during the global financial crisis, we didn't really have much of a reduction in terms of contract value. I think from memory, it just fell about 10%, which I think also this favorable outcome in tough times is a function of the fact that the contracts, and as we mentioned, some are multi-year contracts, they're not going to all come for renewal at a specific point in time during the year. So in general, you do have a few quarters to adjust your P&L. And for example, not just looking at costs, but you can put resources, you can organize your salespeople to really maybe focus more on those people that are upcoming for renewal and have deeper conversation, show them again how even in a recession, the Gartner seat pays for itself. So historically, it's been quite a resilient business. And we can also see it during the period in the recent pandemic when the conference business went overnight to zero. And IT experts are actually quite good at transitioning all these conferences online. So as I said, they only suffered for a couple of quarters, but then they were quite good at reorganizing resources, move all these conferences online, and it was business as usual a few quarters back after.
And looking again at the free cash flow dynamics, which again, when I was researching this, was quite impressed with the earnings conversion to free cash flow. My impression is, as you described before, this is a great working capital dynamic that they benefit from. Is that something where in past cycles you've seen that catch up? It's working capital, so at some point those payments come due. Is there ever been anything in terms of how they've run the balance sheet and that free cash flow swinging in the opposite direction?
Yes, that's a risk that I think most people think about this as soon as they look at the cash flow statement, because it looks so good that you think, is it too good to be true? So at some point, it really is driven by the organic growth. And I think management has been quite aware of the risk. So they've always been trying to grow sustainably. So you've never seen Garnet trying to really push for 20% plus growth. They always incrementally try to hit that 10% or around their growth every year, which keeps things relatively easy to manage. They've never leveraged the balance sheet high, so not doubling down on the risk on liquidity and liabilities falling due. So then they do stress test this quite a bit. And I think what you'll find as well is that because, as we said, not many of the contracts need to be renewed at a specific point in time, you do have always some time to manage through sharp drops in revenues. So when that happens, you at least have a few quarters to manage that. So they never had a big problem in doing this, but it's something that's always on the back of my mind. Because if you have, as you alluded, a 10% to 20% drop overnight in sales, then that big dynamic will work in reverse.
They've been around for a while, so I'm sure it's been tested in several different environments. On the point that you've been making about they are saving their customers money, I think it makes a lot of sense. And that's often the value proposition that you'll hear from a lot of companies and businesses. But it's tough to really tie it directly. I think there's some case to be made that they're saving their executives time, and that time is equivalent to money, or maybe there's a strategic change that they make on the back of a research report. Again, just being a bit removed from the actual decision, and someone has to really apply it to Gartner. Are there other explicit things that are happening which you think really capture the value of Gartner or why the executives will rely on Gartner?
Well, apart from the value that really drive from it in the sense of time saved and ability to actually get something done, and to a very good standard, there is that big intangible benefit of saying, if you do end up making a mistake, well, Gartner said so. They suggested this. What do I know? So that also is that intangible benefit where, okay, you did ask how many dollars does this save? But I think for most people, their reputation, it's worth dollars. I think that's an extra level of value that executive can get out of Gartner. And if I can add another perhaps intangible one, I know you ask about dollar figures, but being able to often go to these conferences and meet other executives doing similar job that you do. So I think they have a very good network where people, once they get in, they quite enjoy to be part of it.
I think your point on the, what I would call CYA clause.
Yeah, I was trying to think another way to say it.
You're cover your backside. Economy, which is a real thing. And I think oftentimes people point to McKinsey being a form of that and is certainly strong in any type of industry. So there's some intangible benefit there. Thinking about the competition point a bit again, I would imagine that in some of the industries that they're expanding into, there are existing players and there are niche players. So have they run into issues with expansion? And when you think about threats, do you consider someone becoming a global player a bigger threat, or that they expand into territories where there's niche players that are tougher to conquer?
That's a great question. So I think the best way to maybe think about this is that let's try to understand what the actual moat of the business is, in the sense, are they going to be 10 years from now still the number one player? And I think when it comes to, we can call it the secret sauce, as most of your guests have done, Gartner success, I think it can really be broken down in two parts. The first one is an unassailable competitive position in the form of superior scale. They are much, much bigger than anybody else. And the second one, and I know it's an intangible one, but I think it's a very important one. It's a cultural edge. So once you combine these two, I think you get that very strong moat that has allowed the business to really become the leader and to continue to grow actually faster than all the other peers, even though the revenue base is already so many multiples times larger. So if we zoom in the scale aspect, Gartner is not a monopoly, but it's the clear number one player. So once you have 10 times more sales than the number two player, you can really outspend them in any shape and form. So Gartner has 2,500 experts, and they can add more if they want to. They can have a better experience for the customer by making better conferences, more conferences. They can add to the library anytime they want. But importantly, there is also a feedback loop. Because Gartner's experts have so many more opportunities to interact with the executives of large corporations, they really have a great understanding of what the pain points are for businesses. So they can really target the research to provide actionable solutions to these pain points. And it's quite powerful. Some of the smaller peers, yes, they can have maybe a niche, but it's very hard for them to replicate this across so many markets. And then if we look also at distribution, that scales matters here too. So Gartner has 4,700 salespeople going around the globe, showing really the value of the Gartner subscription. So that's very tough to compete. And what happens here is that you got this virtuous cycle where better content makes it easy for the salespeople to bring new people in, and new people that come in give you more ability to spend on content. So it's quite hard for players to really become the next global research provider. And then if we move to the cultural edge, I think that's what really turbocharges Gartner's growth and success. They have quite a remarkable performance-driven culture. And what I found, and I think it's very important, is that this is truly set up at the top and then trickles down. Top management works extremely hard and they're very long tenure. And we spoke about before the CEO, Eugene Ho, he joined in 2004. And now it's like, what, 20 years later and he's still there. And nothing changed in the strategy. They've just been hitting targets and they've been extremely accountable to these targets. They never had to change them particularly. And then for high achievers, they can really get out of it long-term careers because the goal is clear. The strategy is not changing that much and people get remunerated quite well. So you got all these three elements creating long-term employees. And when you are a salesperson, I think it's a lot easier to sell something when you really believe in the company and the product. And for the customer, it's a lot easier to buy a product when you're dealing with the same person for a few years. If your contact at Gartner changes all the time, that promise that Gartner really is going to make you save time and add a lot of value maybe falls apart a bit. So I think this cultural edge is really important too.
There's certainly barriers to entry with that level of scale and what they can offer just in terms of the breadth of the product. So regardless of whether it's a monopoly or not, I certainly think that point has been made clear. On the sales force, you gave some description about them being well compensated. Is there anything unique about the sales force when it does come to that compensation, whether it's inclusion of equity? It sounds like there's not too much turnover. I might have that wrong, but I always find it interesting with some of these businesses that can organically grow with logos, price, and other things topped in there, usually find some interesting compensation structures and incentive structures.
Yes, definitely. So I think on the turnover aspect, the cultural high performance aspect of it, it means that it's not for everybody. So the turnover is relatively high for the first few years when people join. But once people go through the sales programs, they learn, they see the success, they really tend to stay there for a long time. And Gartner is particularly keen on paying people for performance. So I'm not sure in terms of what the bonus structure is, but I don't think it's actually that important in the sense that Gartner is also equally interested in rewarding people with equity. And so it's nothing like those software businesses that we've seen in the last few years, which issue equity like crazy. Gartner has been very judicious around this, but has always pushed very hard for people to have skin in the game. So I think that's a big part that explains why those salespeople also stay there for a long time.
Yeah, there's different forms of share-based compensation and extreme levels that you can look at. And I think we have examples like TransDigm, where I think the equity was a big piece of the incentive structure, but did not necessarily play a huge role in terms of what the income statement looked like and what the free cash flow statement looked like. But it's all fair points. This has been an excellent conversation. Starting to wind down a bit here. One of the things you mentioned before was M&A has been a part of their history. When you think about that as a lever for growth, they generate cash flow. There's certainly ways you can spend it. Do you think M&A is something that will be part of the strategy in the future?
I hope, honestly, that it won't. At least talking about big deals, because that would probably put into some question the idea that Gartner's opportunity to grow is very big and very long. So I'll be getting a bit worried if they were to do a big deal, but they do from time to time make small acquisitions to enhance their product. So it might be a software business that makes the portal better, or maybe a small niche research player that adds some capability to the portfolio. The business has been working so well. It has a nice algorithm, delivers 25% returns to shareholders that stay there for the long term. So I think a big deal would introduce more risks than anything else. it would add probably debt to the balance sheet. And as we talked about it, you never know what the future brings. So if you have a big cool off in the economy, you have negative growth, and then that working capital starts to reverse, then you just add risk that you don't need.
Well, this has been great. The closing question that we always have is, what are the lessons or key lesson that you can take from looking at Gartner in this case and potentially apply elsewhere as an investor? What would you point to there?
For investors, one thing that became clear over time for us holding the company shares for a long time is that you don't really have to get seduced into high growth companies to do extremely well. If you combine enough favorable characteristics, you can really have explosive shareholder returns. So don't chase really high growth for the sake of it. Gartner has been growing annual sales at 10%, which for most people, for most growth investors would say, well, that's not that exciting. But the EPS growth has been 25% per annum. So quite a stark difference. And I think this shows that while we all know that organic growth, subscription revenue, margin expansion, high cash conversion, good management with good capital allocations, these are all characteristics that we aspire to see and have in businesses where we invest in. But when you combine all this together, you really get non-linear outcomes. So in a certain sense, you really get more than the sum of the parts. So you could have paid quite a big multiple many years ago and still done quite well. So I think that was a big lesson that we have learned over time. And then if we have to look about lessons for operators, I think Gartner really taught me a lot in the sense that if you have a big growth opportunity, you got to stay focused on only what you can control. And you need to aim to grow sustainably and try to really not bet the farm on anything. Just every day try to get better. Importantly, what Gartner has done very well, I think they've really selected a small number of KPIs. They have been very consistent over time and they've made it very easy to track progress and also to become accountable for the outcomes. So it has been easy as well to pay people for performance because the rules at the beginning were the same as the ones that were at the end and very objective. So that was, I think, something that is very important. And again, I think you mentioned about the acquisitions before, and that's why I see it as a risk, because I think what Gartner has done so well is that they've been incrementally getting better every year for 20 years and longer. So it has not been an overnight success, the result of a big acquisition. It was really getting better every day. And I say as well that not many people probably know about Eugene Hall, the CEO, and his executive team. Obviously, Eugene didn't do it by himself. He had himself surrounded by great, hardworking people. But if you ask around, I don't think many people really know about any of these executives, despite the great success. And I think what they really do well is to really empower the workforce to drive the outcomes.
Well, Alvise, I was intrigued by Gartner when we started the conversation. I'm only more intrigued now. So thank you for sharing all that knowledge. It's a fascinating business, one I wish I had known about before, to be honest, at least a little bit more about how well they've performed. It's a name I'm familiar with. Thank you for coming on and joining us on Business Breakdowns.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's joincolossus.com.